questions are for also, comments are repetitive, so I don't think it's necessary for us to provide full answers where we've done already, so under comments following. With regard to the comments raised by CISA, we said that, or our view is that it might be more appropriate for us to consider that issue when we look at the implementation clauses under 103 and 104, as well as, well, everything under implementation, Mr. Chair. On the next page, page 7, the comment by Abusa, we said that our annexure A to the summary document covers that, so as well as SUNIF. As far as juristic persons is concerned, we feel that we would like to also address that issue later during the summary itself. On page 9, we get a reference to PAHIA and ODAC, comments raised by them. The first issue is that they are of the view that the name of the regulator might not be necessarily that appropriate. Our response is that we noted the comment and that it is proposed in view of the existing functions in terms of PAHIA that will be transferred to the regulator and the functions to be exercised in terms of the bill that the regulator be called the information regulator, but that is an option or proposal at this stage. The bold heading regulator's powers, we said that it might be also more appropriate to discuss that later when we reach the relevant clauses 34 and onwards. The location of the regulator, the budget and resources, we feel at this stage that provisions of the bill present a clear indication that it is evidently something that will be discussed in the committee in any event, Chair. And then with regard to National Archives, we said our view is that the proposal does not fall within the ambit of the bill. With regard to PAHIA and Professor Curry's comments, also like to defer that response when we get to the provisions of Clause 43. As well as the issues raised by the South African Human Rights Commission, I think it justifies a separate discussion when we get to the provisions dealing with the regulator itself. The Cape Bar Council argue that assigning PAHIA's function to the regulator downgrades the right of access to information. The South African Human Rights Commission is a Chapter 9 institution, while the regulator is a statutory body. It gives out the wrong signal to public bodies, and that is the point of view of the Cape Bar Council. Our response is that the South African Human Rights Commission remains an institution supporting constitutional democracy and is tasked with ensuring compliance with Chapter 3 of the Constitution, including its role as champion of all rights contained therein, such as access to information and privacy. The regulatory functions associated with access to information will be transferred to the regulator. It should be noted that the legislature decided to introduce into additional functions to the South African Human Rights Commission in 2000. Page 13, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Chair. And we also would like to note or indicate that the legislature decided to introduce additional functions to the South African Human Rights Commission in 2000 when it promoted the access to information legislation, mindful of its own decision to request that further research be conducted into the possibility of privacy and data protection legislation to be enacted. With regard to the comment in respect of clause 11B, and also the deletion of other than a personal request from section 22 and 54 appears to be a consequential amendment and argue that it's not constitutional. Our response is that since the protection of personal information and the access to personal information by a requester is so closely interrelated, the proposed amendment aims to transfer the right of and procedure associated with access to information of the requester from Act 2 of 2000 to the bill. The right of access to personal information by a requester and the correction of personal information currently regulated in terms of Section 88 of the Access to Information Act are both information protection principles that require regulation in one single piece of legislation. And then we would also like you to note the reference to legislation providing for correction of personal information that is contained in Section 88 of Act 2000. The proposed amendment of Section 1 of PAEA by the substitution of the regulator for the Human Rights Commission would lead to the nonsensical definition of the regulator as meaning the South African Human Rights Commission referred to in Section 181B of the Constitution. Mr. Chair, this is, in our view, purely a technical matter, and when we get to the schedule, we might even point that out to you again. But just to respond to that comment at this stage is to indicate to you that the proposed amendments of Act 2000 reflected in the schedule to the bill, in order to transfer the functions of the South African Human Rights Commission to the regulator, is technically correct, and will not have the effect as pointed out by them. ODAC requests or raises the question, what about access to information contained in the Deeds Office and Companies and Intellectual Property Registration Office, so-called CIPRO databases? Our response is that personal information contained in public register like the Deeds Office is subject to the ambit of the bill. There was no exemption for public records in the EU directive. In 2003, the EU re-evaluated this position and confirmed that public registers should be in full compliance with the principles. The South African Law Reform Commission on page 135 therefore recommended that public registers should be properly regulated since it will be in line with international prescripts and will contribute towards supporting our country and adequacy rating. Mr. Chair, the next two comments we would like to just refer us back to the response under ODAC, and I don't think it's necessary to bore you with the detail there. I think it's quite clear what we mean there. Kusatu argued with regard to public participation that there was insufficient time to consult with the result that the submission focused on a specific issue, also raised the concern that the bill was not tabled for negotiation at NEDLAC, requested the committee give consideration to this process as it assists greater buy-in from stakeholders. And this is merely just a short indication of the feedback that Mr. Ratman gave the committee yesterday regarding the process itself. The Center for Constitutional Rights also raised a question around time. For purposes of consultation, we opted not to respond because we think it is an issue that will and has been addressed so far in the committee. Mr. Mark Henk supports the establishment of an information regulator and indicates that research has shown that regulators both regulation and awareness of rights occurs more swiftly than where enforcement of rights can only be made through the courts. We regarded this as a statement in support of the bill, and we just said noted. That's our response to that. As well as the statement by the Public Service Accountability Monitor. ESCOM said that for greater transparency and independence, there should be the separation of the regulator's dispute resolution and investigative functions. The regulator should not be able to investigate and issue a binding order in a matter where it has been involved in mediating the dispute. And he said, what is considered that should be investigated to finalize by an alternate regulator. Our response is, Mr. Chen, we admit that the issue is very complex, but it should be recognized that there is a need to guard against unnecessary proliferation of regulatory bodies. The establishment of different regulators for aspects which are closely related to each other will increase costs associated with the establishment thereof and contribute towards considerable delay in the implementation of the legislation. The different varying functions of the regulator will contribute towards establishing a sifting mechanism in terms of which the number of court cases will be reduced. The advantage associated with the various functions of the regulator is that the regulator will be in a position to establish itself as a very reliable entity to resolve certain disputes quickly and relatively inexpensively. Enforcement is just another form of mediation. It should be noted that an enforcement notice does not have a penal sanction and it can at best be of probative value if a dispute eventually ends up in court. Alternative dispute resolution consists out of conciliation, arbitration, and mediation. The enforcement notice should be regarded as nothing else as the arbitration leg of the alternative dispute mechanism. First Rank Banking Group raised similar concerns.
Are we just running through this, or can we ask questions?
You can.
Yeah, because I mean, I basically just wanted to know on this the what are the other options, and maybe
we should first. Just to record.
Yeah. What are the other options? The appeal that I can see, maybe it's in the wrong section, is to the High Court, section clause 92. So what are they saying about the regulator also considering appeals? I'm not following that, where that comes from.
I think the system will work as follows. First of all, the regulator will try through conciliation mediation to resolve the issue. If that's not possible, an investigation can be engaged in by the regulator that can end in the enforcement order where the subject is ordered to do something or to stop doing something. If the data subject does not agree with the enforcement order, then he or she can go to court. Where the appeal to the regulator comes in is where there's a code of conduct with the adjudicator, and the adjudicator will then, in fact, make the decide the issue. If the data subject is not satisfied, then the data subject can go to the regulator. So where there's a code of conduct, there's an extra step included in so far as the adjudicator makes the first determination. If there's no code of conduct, then the appeal to the court is after the regulator's made its decision. So there's a decision made by adjudicator, appeal to the regulator, regulator makes a decision, and then there's also still the appeal to the court.
Thank you, Chair. That brings us to page.
Mr. Chairman, just first of all, my apologies for being late. I was involved in this reception of the Nigerian delegation. I also apologize for not being here yesterday on account of the lockup. I don't want to take back the discussion. I have 1,000 questions on this and on the bills. I wonder whether I can receive a word of your guidance on how the process develops from here. We are hearing the department now. We're asking questions for clarity, and then what type of engagement should we envisage? Because I don't want to ask questions now which are better suited for a later stage of deliberations.
Well,
my understanding is that we are dealing with broad themes, but basically as a way of guiding to allow the department to give this presentation. We can occasionally comment and ask questions, but not with the view of resolving issues at this stage. Our job at the moment is to understand what the department seeks to do. And once you've got that, we'll mull over those things. And I think we're going to go clause by clause, by the way. There's still that tedious process where now we must now agree on issues. At that point, that's when real engagement will happen.
Thank you, Chair. That brings us to page 17, part 2 of the summary, which deals with the comments aimed at specific clauses with regard to the preamble. The Center for Constitutional Rights said that consideration should be given to including the following words in the preamble, recognizing that Section 10 of the Constitution of the Republic of South Africa provides that everyone has the right to have their dignity respected and protected. Our response at this stage is that the proposal cannot be supported. The right of privacy, which among others entails the right to have one's personal information protected, is a separate and independent right as envisaged in Section 14 of the Constitution. The ambit of the bill is restricted to the protection of personal information, and any reference to Section 10 of the Constitution will therefore be, in our view, inappropriate. First, during banking, the bill seeks to achieve harmony with international standards, but some aspects of the bill exceed minimum standards in an unacceptable manner. Our response is that the information protection principles as contained in the bill are in line with international accepted minimum requirements, except where the Constitution provides otherwise, for example, where juristic persons are included in the ambit of the bill. The definition of
question, if you, one is the double technical. Would you address me, if you don't mind, on the following proposition? The Constitution says that the juristic person is entitled to all the protections or rights which its nature is capable of. No, to the extent, I don't remember what... No, it says to the extent relating to its nature. So the way I remember the provision of the Constitution is that it gets everything that it's capable of applying to its nature. So obviously it doesn't have the right of shelter, doesn't have the right of health, doesn't have the right... Now, that provision itself, and I'm putting this to you just to be corrected, that provision itself is not subject to the limitation clause, because the limitation clause limits the extent of the right, not the provision of that nature which determines the applicability of the right. So are we constitutionally bound to have protection of the right to privacy, because obviously the right of privacy can apply if we so wish to a juristic entity. Are we constitutionally bound to do so? And if that's the case, isn't that the end of this debate?
Mr. Chair, yes, that is a very interesting angle. And I would tend to agree with that statement at this stage. It's the rights that are limited, but if you have got that constitutional principle that determines that your fundamental rights are applicable to a juristic person to the extent or whatever the phrase is, then that principle certainly that principle cannot be subjected to the limitations clause. But I think what we'll do is we'll certainly would like to discuss this with our state law advisor as well. But I think I tend to agree with that outright, Mr. Chair.
However, even though it can't be dealt with under Section 36, what about the balancing of rights? I mean, you still have to, when you can, not so. And that, I think, will be our avenue, I would think. Because we have by now had a lot of argument, much of it I thought very persuasive, on why it is not desirable. It's a different question from constitutional. But if we are also weighing rights, as we are doing in the case of the media, on which Dr. Ambrosini, we had yesterday interesting, we took certain issues a little further without reaching conclusion. As in the case of the media, I argued the simple fact that we, along with only one other country, have actually constitutionalized media freedom, not just freedom of expression. That has a bearing on how you deal with the media. Now, likewise here, taking Dr. Ambrosini's point, then surely we can consider other principles, like, this is after all, the Bill of Rights that rests on openness, a constitution that rests on openness, and other rights, bring them into play. In order to address some of the concerns, from a purely practical point of view, what is going to start disturbing some business practice and efficacy. But I think it's useful that Dr. Ambrosini has brought this up. We know now against what background we have to think it through.
Maybe allowed another question on the preceding
point. I have a difficulty with this bill. And again, we're all the product of our background. And my difficulty comes from an education in the American legal system, in which at a certain point there was a Privacy Act and a Freedom of Information Act. The Privacy Act defined the right to privacy. Now, in South Africa, we are much more advanced because there is a constitutional definition of the right to privacy. However, I would like to step back, at least to see whether there is common understanding. And going back to the fundamentals, if somebody peeks in your window and you left the window open, your right to privacy is not infringed upon. If you even uses field binoculars and he looks into your open window, your right to privacy is not open because you've not claimed privacy by closing the curtain. As soon as you close the curtain, no matter how feeble the curtain is, you're asserting the right of privacy, and that any instrument used, even a magnifying glass used to offset the protection that you sought to interpose to protect your privacy, creates an infringement. Now, the difficulty that I have with this bill is that this concept of privacy remains left within the Constitution, and I feel the need of having it constitutional. I feel the need of having it expressed in statutory terms as one of the premises. And I'm putting this to the state law advisor and to the department for a comment. Therefore, in my proposed amendment, I had a sentence which I'm trying to retrieve from my computer, in terms of which I suggested a definition of the right to privacy, because that's core to the entire notion of opt-in, opt-out. You haven't taken a step to close the curtain. You haven't taken the box when you were given the opportunity. You are not entitled to privacy. I think we need to have that foundation. Because if somebody is given the opportunity to tick up an opt-out box on an email, you don't want to receive any more of this, tick it out. It happens every time we install any program. It's already ticked in to receive updates and receive newsletter. There are two different boxes, receive updates and receive newsletter. And each of us ticks off the newsletter, otherwise we're going to get once every week. And that's the act of closing the curtain. So we are given constantly options with curtains open, and we've got the opt-out option. Now, to me, that is the threshold that one must require of the consumer or the data or the data subject, the action on its side to protect themselves. and go to the submission given by the media. We give them an opt-out option. They don't opt out, they're given consent. Hence, my submission that we should deal with assent and not with consent. I wonder, because it was the first place issue raised.
I think if we go, this way, we are not going to move at all. No, but the inputs are useful, but too much elaboration. I want him to make his inputs very precise. There's too much motivation, too much examples, which I think might belong to the next phase. At this moment, let's just highlight FLEC issues. That's my sense. Amani?
Thanks for your question. I thought I was getting a bit worried because I think we need to have a common understanding on the process. My understanding is that this is a higher level of classification. It looks better information exchange. It is not a level where, as you said in your remarks, of debating and agreeing or disagreeing on any amendment. In other words, we stretch the department to the best possible clarification level. And then we leave it there. If you have got a different view, you've got a different view. There will be a point where we'll be considering it. And then you throw your views at that level. Am I correct?
Yeah, I want us to ask questions for clarity. I want us to highlight issues which we think are problematic, and we leave it at that. The department can respond to some extent, but it's not their job to satisfy us. It's to give us what informs their view. So that when we debate, we understand where they're coming from.
I would just like to just say about the right to privacy.
It was just that on Dr. Ambrosini's point, I mean, the rights in the Constitution are not defined further than in the Constitution. It's been basically for the courts to determine what they mean. So the right to life, and they're all most well, you know, there's balancings of rights and so on. So the right to life, it was the Constitutional Court that said that includes the fact that you can't have the death penalty. Having the death penalty is not a justifiable limitation. But the right to life doesn't mean that you can't have abortion. So my difficulty would be if we go Dr. Ambrosini's route and define the right to privacy in terms of existing judgment. All these rights develop. What we see as a particular right now may be different in 20 years' time. And are we going to not be then, I mean, obviously it's still for the court to the Constitutional Court to interpret the Constitution and what the rights mean and what their limitations are. But is it a good idea, is it done elsewhere, that ordinary legislation tries to define the right? In a more comprehensive manner. So I just wanted to throw that into the pot.
I just think that question, that intervention again takes us away from Adam's. We are now debating this issue. Once we begin to exchange on this thing, whether we want to put it in the Constitution, what the Constitution means, what it doesn't, we are deviating from this. That I've suggested. And maybe let's just discuss how we want to go forward. My suggestion is that we allow the department to respond to the comments already made, which are written here. So they walk us through their responses. The purpose of the exercise is for us to hear what they are saying to the comments that have come from the public. That's the purpose of this exercise. And in the process, there are questions which we as a committee might want clarified coming out of their responses. So those questions will be allowed. Secondly, there are issues which we think create difficulties, even with clarity. We flag them and say, this is an area of difficulties. And let's highlight it. We'll come back to this because we should rush into the processes which are coming ahead. Otherwise, we will spend, we'll get bogged down here. We'll never move beyond this point. I don't want us to do an improper job, cutting corners and so on, but I think let's define each and every step so that we can do justice to it and so on. But at the same time, we need to progress. That's the reason why I won't allow us to engage in lots of debate, philosophical or otherwise, interpretation and so on. And just to get clarity from the department, they must respond to the issues that have come from the inputs, and then let's flag the issues that we think create problems, and then let's move forward. Thanks.
I would like to respond to two issues. The first is the question of the heuristic person and how to deal with that the problem there. I think one must just be clear about that the heuristic person issue is not does not concern the EU adequacy requirements at all, because it's not it is not an issue that is required in terms of the EU directive. It is also true that most people are not in favour of it in the public responses, and it's also not in line. Including a heuristic person in the bill is not in line really with the international position in other countries. There are exceptions. There are Argentina, for instance, just, their act is quite new, and they've included juristic persons and some other countries as well. But in general, it's not included. So it's really, if we look at this, it is really just a legal question. It is just a constitutional question, and we should look at it in that terms. And I agree with him that we should, also include the state law advisors to see whether it will be possible for a juristic person to go to court and say that this juristic person should be protected and it is not protected. I know that there has been a court case insofar as the National Credit Act is concerned, and we have been referred to that in, I think, First Rand's submission. We have gone into that a little bit, but I think just to state the fact that it is really a legal question, and we will deal with it in that way. Then just insofar as the right to privilege is concerned, I just want to make the general point is that I agree with the Honourable Jeffries that said that the right to privacy is in the Constitution, and it has been developed in our court through court cases, and it's actually changed. I think I would like to refer you to Chapter 2 of the report, where we have quite a comprehensive explanation of how that right changed over time, and where it is really only very recently that it is now being accepted as being a separate right. It used to be part of the right to dignity. It was so your dignity had to be impaired as well before you could impair your privacy. That has changed. It is a separate right, and I think we must distinguish the right to privacy in terms of South African law from the law in other countries because of this development that has taken place and because it has been dealt with specifically in a number of court cases. I know the Chair said we shouldn't look at examples, but just the example of looking through the window, the effect of the fact that we have a separate right to privacy is that if you're in your house, I suppose if you walk around outside naked, you haven't drawn the curtain, as you say, but even if you're in your house and it's reasonable to expect that you will have privacy, and somebody goes to extraordinary lengths, for instance, looking at you through a binocular, your privacy will in fact be impaired, even though you haven't.
What about people who have got binoculars?
What I'm just trying to say is in South African law, if you do not have to realize that somebody is impairing your privacy for it to be impaired. So it's not your dignity that is impaired. You don't even know about it. But the fact is, somebody's imposing on your position. So I just think that one should look at the position in South Africa, you know, because it has been discussed in various court cases.
But do you agree on this? I'm going to close that change, but then we close, because this is really foundational. I mean, I did go through that, and my understanding, and we can expand if need to more opinions, but my understanding is that the critical action of asserting your
the critical action of asserting your privacy is required. You go inside your house. You close the window. There must be an assertion of "I don't want to be seen." And this is very important, because it goes to the play of what is the fault and what is not the fault. And my understanding is that the fault is public. Everything is public, unless by virtue of some of your actions, going into the house, closing the curtain, you make it private.
Yeah. I would want to request through you, in line with the procedure you have proposed, Chairperson, that we speak in the context of clarity and information exchange, because of the temptation to have a different view by other politicians in the meeting to what Honorable Ambrosini is saying. It's no longer a debate between him and the department, and it's a debate of the committee. And I thought what you were saying, there will be a debate in the committee, and that time hasn't come. The department has clarified itself on this issue. And then I would request that Dr. Ambrosini follow the procedure of saying, yes, I have my concerns, and we proceed.
I just think you're so juicy. Something hard to resist. Very hard to resist, but please, let me just appeal to us. Let's just have a little taste, but let's just not go for the meat and the bone, please. Thank you very much. Let's proceed.
Thank you to the department and the honor to. In Act, sorry, we're on page 17. Just wanted to respond to your remark that the examples are juicy, Mr. Chair, by indicating that we have recently promoted our new Sexual Offences Act. So to a certain extent, we would like examples on various issues. We can provide them, and some of them are quite juicy. But that's just a silly little remark. Please excuse me, I couldn't resist the temptation. Mr. Chair, on page 17 at the bottom, the definition of personal information and sensitive information too wide, leading to the well-being and effective, open to abuse and not achieving its objectives. For example, including gender and marital status in the definition can lead to absurd results. Also, for sensitive personal information, information may be sensitive in certain contexts, but in others, in not yet. We said it will be addressed later and to a certain extent immediately thereafter with regard to the definition of ETV. A notion of the answer is already given. The bold defines ETV comments that the bold defines personal information very broadly. Similarly, the bold defines processing to include a wide range of activities. Our response is that the definition of personal information is mainly a duplication of the definition contained in Access to Information Act and the ECT Act. All aspects of the definition are essential elements of the privacy of an identifiable individual. In order to ensure adequate protection of personal information, the bill, through the definition of processing, aims to regulate all aspects of the information cycle by ensuring that the whole cycle is covered from the point of collection up to the point of destruction. Number one. Number two, that all responsible parties are covered. And finally, that all eight information protection principles are adhered to through the different stages of the information cycle. The Public Service Accountability Monitor also started off by indicating that the definition of personal information is too broad. They argue that it may have unintended and stifling consequences for public bodies and certain juristic persons and private bodies that have for render a public function or are paid out of public funds. They further go on to say that subclauses E, F, G, and H are of a particular concern. The examples given is that in terms of paragraph E, the personal opinion, view, preference that an MEC education expresses when his or her department is considering the award of a scholar transport tender would be protected as personal information, undermining democratic governance and accountability principles. The other example is in terms of paragraph G, that an advisor to the DG education recalls a conversation with the DG where he or she acknowledges being an avid creationist and states his or her wish to eliminate any reference to evolution from the primary school curriculum. They argue that this would be protected as personal information, undermining the accountability of public office bearers. Our response is that the processing of personal information is subject to eight protection principles, which aim to establish minimum requirements for such processing. They are in line with principles which have been established more than 20 years ago. The concern pointed out above would have had a direct impact on the principles if it was a real concern. The mere constant application of these principles in foreign jurisdictions did not present a problem and will not present a problem in our own jurisdiction. The aim of the bill is not to promote secrecy. The outcome is not to protect privacy, but to balance privacy with the need for free flow of information, principles with exceptions built into those exceptions, into those principles. It should be kept in mind that the bill aims to protect personal information after it has been imparted by the individual and does not prevent an individual not to impart such information. The bill deals with the right to control personal information after disclosure to others, and in the final instance, it should be kept in mind that it is up to the individual how he or she would like to control that information within the ambit of the bill. It also forms the foundation of and systems for an information society. The Banking Association of South Africa, with regard to the definition of personal information biometric data, said that the definition of biometric data should be amended to read, including but not limited to fingerprinting DNA. This is a technical issue, Mr. Chair, so I don't know whether it's really necessary to respond now, apart from just indicating that it is acknowledged that the wording but not limited to are not consistently used in the bill where open-ended lists are provided. However, it is recommended that the wording is redundant and should therefore be removed when necessary. We could also receive the guidance from our state law advisors who assisted us with the specification of the bill. But generally, on a technical basis, one would feel very strong that if you have an open-ended list, it's not really necessary to include the words, but not limited to. But, Mr. Chair, I suppose that's something that will also receive further attention during the deliberations. The response by ODAC with regard to the definition of information, personal information, juristic persons, and personal information of juristic persons will also be addressed under the old juristic person question, as well as comments raised by the Credit Bureau Association, Massmart, South African Breweries on page 20, Eskom, and also the Nelson Mandela Fund. Mr. Chair, then Saha indicated that at the bottom of page 20 that the definition of personal information in Bahia should be amended to make it consistent with that in the Protection of Personal Information Bill, and we would like to come back to this when we get to the schedule to the bill, Mr. Chair. First rank banking also refers to juristic persons. We would like to address that later as well. Then,
where they say they are your Google address link. Many of them.
That only appear maybe, Mr. Chair. It's just the old question around heuristic persons. And what we are thinking of is possibly to prepare a note, depending on the time available to us, similar to the initial A note that dealt with the press, and present it at the conclusion of this summary.
And there will be areas where they're not able to actually clarify.
No.
Yeah, they'll be looking for advice from the state law advisors. So the late house mean those two things.
I would just like to add what Henke said. I think what's very important is that one must realize that some of the areas or some issues have received a lot of attention. However, what is important for this bill is really the principles, the monitoring, and the enforcement. Issues such as heuristic persons, journalists, direct marketing, all the issues that are really getting a lot of attention, they are really ancillary matters. It would not really, the law is not going to be made or broken whether journalists are included or not, or whether juristic persons are included or not, or whether direct marketing gets out or opt in. So those are issues to be decided, and it's very important for those people, but that's not really what the bill is about. And I think what we're trying to do is just to go through the bill, to look at the actual core of the bill, and then deal with these issues as specific issues at the end of the process.
I think you're complicating my answer now. That's why the hand of
I'm asking for your guidance, Mr. Chairman, not to raise an issue. I'm going to place a difficulty on record, which I would like to have addressed and for you to decide when and how, but it is just the opposite of what has been said. I have an enormous difficulty in understanding the scope of application of this bill, the intended scope, and what is the actual unintended scope, which to me is the common thread to all these issues. And to me, I'm fine with the enforcement mechanism, and I don't have a problem with that, for as long as we understand to whom it applies, why, how, and what is it that we are trying to achieve, and whether the bill reflects that intention or goes way beyond what was intended.
Now, I think, like I pointed out, that he's created problems for me, because that's an area of discussion. That's the understanding of what the bill is all about. The committee's understanding might be totally something else. It might expand on the understanding. It might actually reduce that following when we begin to discuss the bill. So basically the answer to your question is what I've said. And Dr. you can rest assured we are going to define the ambit of the bill. What is its objectives and so on. Those would be the principles and so on. So we are going to come there at the right time. At the moment, we are being inducted into the bill in the form of a response. This is the second phase of induction, form of response to the briefing, and then the inputs into the process by the interested parties who are responding to that.
Mr. Chairman, may I just ask Ms. Lowe just to proceed for 2 minutes? I would just like to excuse myself for a second, please.
You can take the cell phone with you. if you did it.
Okay, I think we now have the definition of responsible party. I think the submission was made that responsible party is too broad. There should be a distinction between organizations that pursue public interest objectives and private sector entities that are profit-seeking. And the response here is that any processing of personal information by any entity inherently presents on page 21, and it's the definition of responsible party.
Okay.
The response here is that any processing of personal information by any entity inherently presents the risk of interference with the protection of personal information as a data subject, which results from a breach of the information protection principles. It is precisely for this reason that the ambit of the bill cannot be restricted to commercial activities only. We are actually, that is the point that is made, is that it is supposed to be broad. CGE says the definition is ambiguous and should refer to clearly described entities. It should be a natural or juristic person that is authorized by law or an agreement with the data subject to collect the information. Our response is the definition is not ambiguous. It in fact follows existing definitions of public and private bodies provided for in other pieces of legislation. The risk of attempting to provide a list of entities lies in the fact that if an entity is then not mentioned in the definition, it will automatically be left out, which is not the intended purpose. SANEF opposes the exemptions given to the police and security forces whose extent of powers are open to abuse. We said it should be kept in mind that the exclusion in paragraph C is conditional to the extent that adequate safeguards have been established in other legislation. The exercise of power by public bodies, even if left unregulated in terms of the legislation, is, of course, also subject to the provisions of the Constitution.
I misunderstood, Mr. Hank, because what you are saying now in page 21 at the end slightly contradicts that kind of explanation. Where you say the risk of attempting to provide a list of entities lies in the fact that if any entity is not mentioned, it will automatically be left out. I thought he had said, when there was a question, that why don't you include a clause that's not limited to, that he was saying it would be regarded in itself that it is not necessary. Is there no conflict in that explanation with regard to this?
I think the difference is it's just a drafting issue. I think if you say this includes, and then you add in little brackets, but not limited to, that's actually just confirming what you've just said. Because if it's included, it includes the following. It just adds that just as an extra, but not limited to. If you take out the but not limited to, it has exactly the same meaning still. So it's just a duplication of the word. The word include already. Means that it's not limited to. So it's just a drafting issue. It's not a principled issue. In this case, if you say these people are included in the bill, and that's it, then nobody else is included. If you say that, or not included, if that's the wrong word to use. If you say the bill is applicable to the following person, and you list it, then it means the bill is only applicable to them. But if you say the following includes people, then it means other people can be added. So it's not a principled question, it's just a question of trust.
Another question?
Mm-hmm.
May I ask you about the SANEF item, the exclusion of the police and security forces, in your phrasing, is conditional to the extent that adequate safeguards have been established in other legislation. Adequate measured against what?
Mr. Chair, the adequate safeguards in other legislation, the principle, you will recall that we explained in Section A yesterday, that if you are free, like the media, to exclude yourself from the operation of the Act on the basis of a code of conduct. The code of conduct must be aligned to the principles of the information protection principles contained in the bill. The approach will be a similar approach will have to be followed in order to determine whether there is adequate safeguards in the other legislation. If I may use a quick example, and it's not necessarily with regard to the operations of security forces, but if you look at, for example, the Sexual Offences Act, the new Sexual Offences Act, Chapter 6 thereof creates the National Register for Sex Offenders. If you look at the safeguards that were built in, into that whole process of information being forwarded from the courts to the registrar only under certain circumstances may divulge that information on application. After a period of time, if a person's personal particulars have been deleted from the register, the registrar is under an obligation to delete all records in his or her possession in respect of that person, etc. Then if you look at that structure created in terms of that legislation, it is actually quite nicely aligned to the eight information protection principles, and one could very convincingly, in my view, argue that there is actually adequate safeguards in that separate piece of legislation. But however, that is now just an example that I use in order to indicate that it will be an objective test that will have to be determined. You will have to look at the legislation that provides for the operations, for example, of the security forces, and as far as they relate to the gathering of whatever of personal information, they must be aligned to the
We will leave that to the court to determine the adequacy or otherwise.
Mr. Chair, no, this is an exclusion. As soon as the courts come into play, there will be the assumption that it is based on a dispute that has arisen. Yes, that is.
I'm not sure whether Member Smart is coming from the same area of Musa. I think the challenge here, Mr. Young, is that if there was no positive exclusion in the Act, this difficulty would not emerge. I think this is my understanding, that the fact that you say positively excluded and subject to the safeguard without clarifying what those safeguards would be, there is a little bit of dilemma that you have actually categorized a certain group of people in society and say, we exclude you, but you say subject to certain safeguards, but you do not explain what would be the minimum principles of those protocols, of those safeguards. You assume that. I think that's where the challenge is. Because the point I'm trying to make is that, in order to clarify my concern, is that such people may find themselves in court, and then depending on this, on how the court interprets, the court might find others right and others wrong. And yet they had no principle minimally guiding them. Where would be their safeguard be adequate for the purpose of protocol of the Act? Yet having been positively excluded by the Act. I'm not saying for long. This is a matter that I think we'll discuss it as we move ahead. That is where, to me, I find the dilemma.
I think what one must just also take into account is the privacy framework in South Africa, and also the privacy framework that will be evaluated to determine whether we have an adequate privacy framework. It's not only this bill. The bill is just the starting point. It's just a framework for this privacy framework. The bill, you have to look, if you look at the framework, it is the bill, together with all the sector-specific pieces of legislation dealing with privacy, together with the regulations in all cases, together with the codes of conduct. And all of that together forms the privacy framework in South Africa. And in that sense, the laws that national intelligence or the police service may have, which deal specifically with the protection of personal information, will form part of this framework. All of that has to be harmonized. And in that sense, if you talk about adequate safeguard, it means that it has been harmonized. So if you look at the police service, for instance, they will protect personal information in harmonization with the principles. But since the principles say, in many instances, it has to be reasonable or that whatever, it will be reasonable in the context of police services. In that sense, if they protect the privacy of a person who's in jail, adequately in terms of international prescripts, etc., that would mean that they have complied with adequate safeguards within the police service, and that will become part of our privacy framework in South Africa. So it's not, you will not only look at the law itself.
See, Mr. Chairman, this is it's difficult to be in your chair.
I appreciate that.
No, but I have a sense that perhaps the progress would require to have those debates when we have them, even if it's a matter of having a little of a syncopatic discussion where we stop and go, because I think the things which are being said here are important, and even if there are other engagements. And on the basis of that, excuse, Mr. Chairman,
No. Let me explain. We are going to discuss this thing. I want to assure members that we will not avoid or dodge the fundamental debate, including philosophical ones. Well, they'll be crucial to inform what goes into the bill itself, the content. This, at this stage, is the phase where we are seeking the departmental response. They may provoke us, which they are doing in responding. That's why when I said it becomes a bit juicy, because they throw certain things at us and we want to bite, you know, and maybe let's call it a mess. But just stick to basically the things that I've suggested we do. We can call them back. By the way, when we go close by close, I believe they are coming here to be with us. Is that correct?
Yes, sir.
That's correct. So the department is not getting off scot-free. but at the moment, it's their day to bask. So let's do that.
Mr. Chair, maybe just a request your guidance. We are a bit cash-strapped at the moment, so if the committee could proceed without us, clause by clause, it would be much appreciated on a financial basis.
We are going to ignore that, but in any event, even if we are to be here or not here, it's still our call. We are still going to make the law. We make the law. Your job is to help us make a good law. Okay. Thank you. Let's go.
Thank you, Chief. Mr. Chair, yes. We are on page 22 now. And we'll be proceeding with the ODAC response. They raised a similar point, and we simply say that we feel that the previous response is sufficient to also address what they've raised there. The Public Service Accountability Monitor recommends that the exclusions also cover all public interest organizations and or individuals acting in pursuit of the public interest. Our argument is that any processing of personal information by any entity inherently presents the risk of interference with the protection of personal information of a data subject, which results from a breach of the information protection principles. It is precisely for this reason that the ambit of the bill cannot be restricted to commercial activities. The clause should have an additional exemption which excludes public bodies that are legally required to maintain public records from the ambit of the bill. It proposes the insertion of a new paragraph H, which will read, by public bodies that are required by law to maintain public records. The department would like to respond at this stage by indicating that all information principles are just as relevant to public records as any other record that is subject to. The question can be raised, why should public bodies not keep accurate public records? Why should they not be accessible, and why should they not be kept secure? Just to refer to a few examples as far as the principles themselves are concerned. SUNEF's concern with regard to paragraph 4.4D was discussed yesterday. Mr. Chair, you will remember that we referred you to Annexure A and also took you through Annexure A. For the benefit of the members that might not have been here yesterday, Annexure A, if we refer to Annexure A, of course, it is the attachment, my apologies, to the summary document itself.
Opening that debate, which I unfortunately wasn't able to be here for yesterday. But what is a journalist? What is journalistic?
You can try. You don't have to satisfy us. You can just try to explain what it is. According to the bill, or a SUNEF for that matter, how they define themselves.
Mr. Chair, please excuse me. I can really not resist the temptation, but the question is similar to the question that was raised in the American jurisdiction, and I'm so told I didn't study that. But the question was, what is the definition of pornography? And after a long debate,
let's go for the jacket. Give it to them, brother.
But see, I don't think it's very difficult to miss a journalist. I think you know one when you see one.
I'm sorry for giving back. Let's have this out, at least what this issue, because it's so crucial. And it is one that we struggle. I get, since you can tell when you see it, I get a letter every week from Ellen Ziller. I guess. I know. And I'm not confident. I suspect that I'm not the only one. And I suspect that I'll keep your okay. So, I mean, is she a journalist? She writes of the same things. I mean, everything is press. The most important freedom of the press is that they're not being registered or not being defined. And I can start a newspaper here and now in any way means available to me to circulate my idea in a way capable of carrying the ideas other than my voice. That's journalism.
I think that there are two things that one must just remember. The first thing is that it is not the intent of the bill to exclude specific persons. It will exclude anybody. It actually excludes the activity. Personal information for exclusively journalistic purposes by responsible parties who are okay, let's just stop there, by responsible parties. So it's the activity that is excluded, not the actual person or the institution. It's not like a media organization. Some bills refer to media organization or whatever. We do not do that because the EU directive specifically states that it should be the activity and not the person that should be excluded. What is, however, important is that that was exactly the reason, and I'm sorry that you actually missed yesterday's presentation, because we went through the principles and looked at them, and our submission is that it is actually not necessary for an exclusion for journalistic purposes, and that was the reason why it wasn't included in the original discussion paper bill, which was published for comment. Because of the fact that it was so difficult to determine who is now actually a journalist and who's just a blogger or whatever, and when do you move towards actually being called a journalist. So it is true that it's impossible to make that distinction these days, because anybody can be a publisher. However, that was exactly why we've included, if you look at the bill, it says exclusive generalty purposes, that's the activity. But then we said, okay, we're only going to exclude those people who, by virtue of office, employment, or profession, is subject to a code of ethics. And that is specifically to exclude bloggers, because they can just be like anybody else. They can go, they can just comply with all the personal information principles, which the journalists can actually also do. What we gave them in D is only the provision that they can self-regulate. And so it's not the actual, we are not excluding them from the principles. We are excluding them from the regulatory functions of the regulator and the bill and all the other sections in the bill. So I think that I take the point that it's difficult to distinguish between journalists and bloggers, but that is, we have taken that into account, and this is exactly why it has been phrased the way it has been. The point that I think that is very important is that the submission has been made by the media that the principles will impair the freedom of expression, and that is not the case. So all the arguments that follow from that is actually not correct, because they have not taken into account the exceptions that are built in each principle. They have just taken the first line of the principle, and they haven't really read through the principle as a entity.
Yes, Mr. Chair, thank you. Maybe just to summarize then, in paragraph D, you have those terms which are not defined, but they are restricted. That is the bottom line with regard to the wording who are subject to by virtue of office, employment, or profession, the code of ethics. Chair, still on page 22. Whether the exemption for journalists is sufficient, will the law undermine freedom of the press, etc., etc. We also refer to Annexure A, Mr. Chair. I think we really, that the Annexure A really cover all four corners of the whole press question at this stage, in our view. So, with regard to Avusa as well, we refer to Annexure A. With regard to the clause 4E, the Public Service Accountability Monitor, they raised the question why the Executive Council of a province and the Municipal Council of a municipality is exempted. Also, these are not exempted in terms of PAHIA, as well as the consequences. Other legislation permits the processing of personal information relating to parliamentarians, executive members, and certain public officials. And the examples they give is the Executive Members Ethics Act of 1998, the Local Government Municipal System Act of 2000, Code of Conduct for Members of the National Parliament, various codes of conduct adopted by the 9 provincial legislatures, and the Public Service Regulations. Our response at this stage, Mr. Chair, is the exclusion is based on the provisions of Act 2 of 2000, but not similar. So consideration may be given to removing references to provinces and municipalities in paragraph E, in view thereof that the above legislation already regulates the processing of personal information. You will recall, Mr. Chair, when we conducted our briefing, it was also an issue that was raised, and I think we already received an indication from the committee in which direction they would like to move. Office of the Premier of Gauteng argues that Clause 6 is better placed in Clause 3. Now, Clause 6 deals with the application Clause 6 provides that the Act applies to public and private bodies. Our response at this stage is that Clause 3 refers, among others, to processing by or for a responsible party. The term responsible party is defined as a public or private body, and the terms private and public body are also defined. Both clauses 3 and 6 deal with the application of the legislation, and there is no technical reason, in our view, why the provisions of Clause 6 cannot be included in Clause 3. Or, on the other hand, Mr. Chair, can even be argued that there is no need for Clause 6 at all, and consideration may even be given to omitting the entire clause from the bill. South African Insurance Association and Woolworths...
Am I correct that the only premier's office in the country that has responded to the bill? Seems so. Honorable Ngunguvel is responsible for that, I suspect.
Thank you, Chair. The South African Insurance Association and Woolworths raises implementation issues. We would prefer discussing all the implementation issues under the provisions of Clause 104, with your permission, Mr. Chair. The Office of the Premier of Gauteng really became on a roll then, and they said that how will this particular provision be monitored? And that is Clause 7, Mr. Chair. And our simple answer is that the regulator will exercise various functions in terms of, well, including monitoring and enforcement. I think we do not need to elaborate at this stage, but I think the answer is quite clear. MIH Internet Africa, with regard to the provisions of Clause 10.1, indicated that it's unnecessary to comply with the requirements of Section 10.1 if the data processor is merely processing personal information that is already in the public domain or accessible by the public on request, provided that the data processing is not contrary to the legitimate interests of the data subject. Our response is that since the information protection principle should be read collectively, it should be noted that personal information, which is in the public domain, is dealt with in other clauses where it is more relevant. For example, Clause 11.2a. Kusatu argues that Clause 10.1a refers to the data subject's consent. Consent must be defined in a broad sense to ensure that consent is without coercion or duress. Uneven power relationship between employers and employees refers to ILO on informed and explicit consent. Explicit consent normally means written consent. There would need to be justification for no written consent, for example, illiteracy. We respond by indicating that Clause 1 defines consent as, among others, any voluntarily specific and informed expression of will. The term voluntary implies that the consent is given without coercion or under duress, for example. The question whether consent is given voluntarily is a factual one that will depend on the circumstances of each case, including whether there is an employer-employee relationship. It's argued that it's not necessary to include a reference to coercion or duress in the definition. Kusato also argues that there should be consultation with trade unions. We respond by indicating that the ambit of the bill is limited to the protection of an individual right and does not specifically aim to regulate the employer and employee relationship, first of all, Mr. Chair. Secondly, trade unions which operate mainly under the labor law is not prohibited from raising any aspect of the law which will encompass the protection of personal information bill once enacted, as far as it relates to or impact on employer and employee relationships. However, we would also like to indicate that consultation with trade unions is a matter that could be and will most probably be considered for inclusion in the specific sector's codes of conduct.
That's also funny,
Ned Lack. Ned thing. The unions are there. They are discussing this in the network.
Yes,
Chair. Any statement authorizing connection disclosure of information signed by the worker should be specific regarding the person, institution, organization, name, address, and the purpose for which the data is being collected, and the time period in which the statement stands to reason that our response excluding that the above proposal relates to the type of detail that should be left out for inclusion in the code of conduct. It should be regarded as directly relevant to the protection of personal information in any given sector. It should also be kept in mind that the conditions of the bill, with the exception of clauses 25 to 33 and 66, do not require consent in view thereof the framework of the bill is not consent driven. Sato also said that before obtaining consent to data collection, employees should be adequately informed of the process, the applicable rules, and their rights. First of all, we would like to point out that clause 1 defines consent, among others, as specific and informed expression of will. And therefore, we argue that the data subject should be informed of all relevant aspects before consent is given. However, the bill is not consent-driven, since the practical implication of a requirement for consent is not necessarily to be advantage of the data such. Clause 43.1b provides that the regulator may, for purposes of promoting the protection of personal information, undertake educational programs on each of her own behalf or in cooperation with persons or authorities acting on behalf of the regulator. USA, clause 10.2, in its current form, hinder business operations and is open to abuse. Business often retains historical information to assess payment history and other information pertinent to its commercial interest. The provider should be added to the clause, and that provider should read, in the event the operator cannot demonstrate reasonable grounds for retaining such personal information. Our response is simply that the proposal appears only to be a rewording of the current requirement. English and multi-choice recommends that the responsible party should have recourse if the data subject objection is frivolous, unjustified, or unreasonable. We point out that such laws can introduce the requirement of reasonable and provide that the data subject may only subject on reasonable grounds relating to legal or particular situation against the processing of personal information. The aforementioned requirement will prevent the data subject from objecting to the processing of personal information in a frivolous or unjustified manner. The Office of the Premier of Gauteng stressed the view that there is a need for further clarity on who determines reasonable grounds for purposes of this inquiry. In the first instance, it will be required of the responsible parties to determine whether the objection of the data subject is reasonable or not. Should the responsible party be of the view that the objection is not reasonable, he or she will decide to continue with the relevant process. However, clause 10 aims to give effect to one of the information protection principles. Chapter 10 of the bill aims to regulate the enforcement of the provisions of the bill and, among others, provides in clause 71, a record clause 70, that a person may submit a complaint to the regulator with regard to the interference with the protection of the personal information of a data subject, which interference may, among others, consist of any breach of the information protection principle. The regulator is blessed with certain powers to react to such complaints and will, in the course of detailed investigation, have to determine whether reasonable grounds are present or not.
Mr. Chair, you're really driving us hard. May I ask for 5 minutes?
Yes, I'm
good. Thank you.
Yeah, let's relax. There are only two of you here, you know? There are only two of you here. I've got to rule with mercy as well. And compassion. Let's do whatever we can. Yeah. Thanks.
Chair, I've got it on good advice at this stage that the committee would prefer just reading the rest of the document, and then we could possibly just convene. But no, Mr. Chair.
Can we take a vote on
that? No, we can't take a vote on that. You see, I think it's very important for the stakeholders to hear from the department what your responses are. We're not too far, I can see. So said to the La Pasea one. Yeah, I think let's go through with it.
Sorry, I don't see anything from the Office of Premier of the
Popo. In your No, great minds. Things alike. I noticed that too. But then they're all in the options.
Apologies, Mr. Chair, and there's more bad news on the way. We went on last night with a summary, so we would like to, if we finish here, bring back some more responses. I understand that the committee is going to work until 1 o'clock today, and we'll try to work that in as well. We're on page 26 of 28, 29.
What's the bad news?
Chair, the bad news is that when we went home last night, we started working on the remainder of the summary that we couldn't complete. So if we finish the remaining pages, we would like to maybe just request a short recess so that we can quickly go and print those pages and copy them and bring them back to the committee.
Yes,
Mr. Chair.
It's going to be difficult. I think what tomorrow is caucus, huh? It's caucuses. It's past 11 now. Let's go on with 11. Let's see how far we go.
Thank you, Chief. Mr. Chair, MIH Internet Africa, with regard to clause 10.2 and 3, argues that where the exemption applies, no data subject. On page 26, Mr. Chair, in the middle of the page, MIH Internet Africa, who argues that where the exemption applies, no data subject may exercise his or her rights in terms of section 10.2 and 3. As the data subject's privacy right is not being infringed. The ambit of subclause 1D to F, we would like to point out, is very wide and therefore requires, in view of the objective of the bill to promote a balance between protection of personal information and the free flow of information, that the data subject should be able to raise an objection as provided for in subclauses 2 and 3. Clause 11.1, MNET multi-choice. Exceptions should also allow for information to be collected by an entity in the same group of companies or other entities as the responsible party. Similar, an entity ought to be allowed to share information with entities in the same group. In terms of clause 11.1, the concern is addressed at clause 11.2d4. However, with reference to clause 15, it should be kept in mind that the further processing should be compatible with the purpose of collection. With regard to clause 11.2a, the CGE argues that it's too broad. the word deliberately should be replaced by intentionally, and consent should be replaced by informed consent. This will keep the clause in line with sections 10 and 14 of the Constitution. We argue that it's submitted that the terms deliberately and intentionally bear the same meaning. Consideration may be given to replacing the term deliberately with intentionally. The term consent is defined in clause 1 as voluntary, specific and informed expression of will. The use of the requirement of informed expression of will therefore makes the proposal with regard to informed consent redundant. MIH Internet Africa clause 11.2a provides a list of circumstances in which data processors will be exempt from the requirement of clause 11.1 to obtain personal information directly from the data subject. Recommend that the exemption is spelled out. Paragraph A should be amended to read, the information is contained in, and then they propose the insertion of the words, or derived from, a public record. We argue that it appears that the proposal is aimed at enabling responsible parties to engage in profiling. The proposal appears to be in order, however, it should be kept in mind that the practice of profiling is also dealt with in clauses 44.3e and 55.1a. With regard to 11.2d6, the CGE argues that the wording legitimate interests is too wide. 11.2d6 should be deleted because it could lead to abuse where people will be able to claim legitimate interest where personal information is misused. Our response is that clause 11 only pertains to collection directly from the data subject. The fact that it's not necessary to collect the information directly from the data subject will not lead to abuse because the responsible party still has to comply with all other information protection principles. With regard to clause 12, the SAIA argues that the data subject will have to be informed of the purpose of the collection of personal information. Product terms and conditions will have to be reviewed to ensure those data subjects are aware of the purpose of the collection of personal information. Our response is that the review of product terms and conditions may or may not be a direct consequence of the requirement contained in the clause, but if so, it will have to be reviewed. Clause 14.1, CGE argues that the sub-clause 1 is ambiguous and is in conflict with paragraphs A to E. 14.1 should be amended to read as follows: must not be retained any longer than what is permitted by any law for achieving the purpose. We argue that it's not clear why the introductory part of subclause 1 should be regarded as being in conflict with paragraphs A to E. The introductory part presents the general rule, and paragraphs A to E present the circumstances on which deviation from the general rule are allowed. The proposal for the amendment of the introductory part of subclause 1 is not feasible since the retention of personal information is not regulated under all circumstances. However, it should be protected under all circumstances. The Office of the Premier of Gauteng recommends that a time frame is given to monitor non-compliance with the section. We are of the view that the proposal appears not to be feasible in view thereof that the provisions of Clause 14 are applicable to many different scenarios, each with its own statutory requirement where applicable. Kusatu argues that the retention of records, its use and purpose should be done subject to consultation with the relevant bargaining structures. And our response is that the above proposal will be best addressed in the required codes of conduct. Mostert Opperman and the SABS committee. Proactive retention of records for evidentiary purposes argues that there is no provision for the normal proactive retention of records for evidentiary purposes. The exceptions in paragraphs A to D do not cover this. It recommends that the following is inserted in 14.1b. The responsible party requires the record for lawful purposes relating to its functions or activities, and then they propose the following words to be inserted: all for the protection of its legal rights. We submit that the phrase lawful purposes related to its functions or activities is wide enough to include protection of legal rights. We therefore not, do not support the proposal. With regard to clause 14, 4 and 5, Mossad Opperman and the SAFS committee, destruction, deletion of records, documents often backed up and unstructured sequential media magnetic tapes that are not search or edit friendly, used for disaster recovery purposes to restore systems, not normal record repositories. And they go on like that, Mr. Chair, and we just responded at this stage that we would also like to address that at a later stage. With regard to clause 15, Kusatu, the processing of any personal information, including further dissemination, should be done subject to consultation with the relevant trade union and through collective bargaining processes. We also indicated that the above proposal will be best addressed in the required codes of conduct. CGE, with regard to clause 15, further processing should be clearly defined in clause 1. Further processing could mean that personal information is disguised and held for longer periods than lawfully permitted. We argue that the provisions of subclause 1 are clear and unambiguous, and it is submitted that it do not require any further clarification through an attempt to define the term further processing. The term processing is defined, and it stands to reason that any processing that takes place after personal information was collected will amount to further processing. Clause 15.1, Office of the Premier, Gauteng. Unclear how it will be determined whether personal information was used for the purpose it was collected for. The meaning of further processing is unclear. Also, it is not clear how the passing of information to third parties is regulated in the toll. We refer to the response in respect of comments by CGE as far as the proposed definition of further processing is concerned. Further processing, on the other hand, includes distribution to third parties. It is recommended that the introductory wording reflected in subclause 3 should be amended to clarify that it contains a list of conditions where prima facie incompatible processing is regarded to be compatible with the purpose of collection. It is recommended that the wording is compatible should be replaced with is not compatible. Mr. Chair, this is an extremely technical issue, and when we go through the provisions clause by clause, we will, in any event, from our side, raise that issue and attempt to explain to you why we would like, from our side, to insert that amendment in any event. 15.3 of WUSA, they raised the concern that clause 15.3E will prevent journalists from retaining personal information purposes of future reporting for use in claims that might be brought against them, and to maintain an effective archive. And there we also refer to Annexure A, which we discussed yesterday.
That deals with the document that we have. Is there any other thing you want to deal with from here? You've got something to fetch.
Yes, Jay.
Yeah, you know what? Let me suggest the following. I don't know if it will make sense to us. How far are we in with the response? Is this half of the document?
Yes, Chair, roughly halfway.
Christian? Half are we? And those 26 pages are not here. They are in the machine. Is that my understanding?
Yes, that's correct. But
yeah, okay. All right. Now, what we should do, let's get the pages ready to distribute to members. today. Well, we're at 20 past 11 now. How long will it take you to get those documents first?
To have a photostatic copy here, Mr. Chair, nothing more than 15 minutes.
Nothing more than 15 minutes. If the members are ready, we can wait for you. Can break for 15 minutes, wait for you to bring the documents. And what we'll do, we'll at about half past 12, stop. And the remainder will go and read. And then we meet on, we allow the parties, yeah, we then allow the parties to go and mull over whatever on Tuesday in the caucuses. Wednesday we start with cross that loss. Could we agree on something like that? Yeah, I think we want to get the remainder of the pages, but we must also give to the stakeholders who are here. We have not had time to have said to yeah, to your, I've got it, to your responses. So we are going to have a mixture of what was being proposed earlier on and what I'm proposing. We'll try and push until about 12:00, because some of us need to have lunch. We are starting at 1 on chairpersons and meetings, and there's a sitting at 2. So that's part of the difficulty I've got. So we'll wait for you, we'll break a bit, smoke time and whatever. Once you are ready, you ask us to come in, and then you distribute the documents. Yeah. Oh, sorry. Yeah. Comfort time. Let's call it comfort time. Yeah. Yeah, and then we'll follow the procedure like that. Yeah. So when they will be back here to go into the evening. No. We're going for comfort time. Yeah.
You're changing your mind, you don't even think of it. If I knew,
we look like we are
confused. I don't know, Brian, you know, I don't know if there's a person that could let me.
I'm just thinking of something. So, for example, another candidate is out of the track. Now, if you move
Requirement is further elaborated to the extent that subclause 2 provides that the required steps should be determined in line with the purpose for which the proposal for which the personal information is collected or further processed. It is submitted that clause 16 requirement is a factual question which will be determined on the merits of each and every individual case. Any attempt to introduce a requirement in respect of data subjects will be contrary to the general nature of the clause. Shifting the burden to the data subject, therefore, appears to be impracticable. MassMart, also with regard to clause 16, indicates that it's too onerous on the responsible party. The consumer should have the duty to report changes to information. We argue that it should be kept in mind that updating should take place in terms of subclause 1 only when necessary. Shifting the burden to the data subject is not practicable. Then the CGE proposes a new subclause 3. A new subclause 3 should be added, and they argue the following words should be used. The data subject must be informed annually of the personal information held by responsible parties who are transacting same for monetary gain or where the information has an adverse impact on the data subject. The proposal is not supported in view thereof that it will create an additional burden which is not proportional to any advantage associated therewith. Clause 17.2 CG. Clause 17.2, the onus on the responsible party should be raised to ensure that meaningful and proper steps are taken to ensure awareness of the data subject. The word reasonably should be replaced by necessary. We submit that the test of reasonable tactical steps presents a fair and just test for purposes of compliance with the relevant principle. The test has in any event been used consistently in other provisions of the bill and is therefore not supported. 17.1 and 17.2 emit multi-choice. Uh, Mr. Chair, that is the whole issue of the notification requirement, and we simply responded that this matter has been addressed in the committee on 27 October. That was yesterday. Clauses 17 and 50, ESCOM. Clauses 17, the notification of the once again, Mr. Chair, I don't know whether it's necessary to read what they say there. I think it's quite straightforward that they raised certain issues with regard to notification. The matter was addressed in the committee yesterday. Clause 17.6A, Office of the Premier of Gauteng. Clause 17.6A is unnecessary. The bill seeks to protect the rights of data subjects, and the provision is contrary to this. We argue that it's an established principle in law that a person may voluntarily agree to certain actions, even if it might be his or her own detriment. Clause 17, a new sub-clause, 7, it is recommended that the following words be included. Where a responsible party has collected data prior to promulgation of this Act, and where the requirements of Section 72 were not fulfilled, then steps must be taken within a period of 12 months after promulgation of the Act by the responsible party concerned to ensure such compliance in order to continue to hold, utilize, or process any personal information that falls in the category. The proposal appears to have some merit, but the provisions of Subclause 6C and especially E should be kept in mind. In view of the aforementioned provisions, the proposal may appear to be redundant. With regard to Clause 18, Mostert and Opperman and the SAPS Committee, records management and preservation of integrity of information. They argue that generally accepted standards with regard to record management are recognized. See, for example, the standards contained in the SABS Technical Committee standards, etc., and they argue that it's also relevant to Clause 14. Honestly, Mr. Chair, it was a bit difficult to determine how we should respond to it, and it appeared to us to be merely a statement, so we just indicated that we noted it. Kusatu argued that it should stipulate that there is appropriate confidentiality training of security personnel and those processing personal information. The requirement for security measures to be introduced is clear and unambiguous according to us, the department. The manner in which the requirement is to be complied with is left open for the different implementation actions to be conducted by the different responsible parties. With regard to Clause 18, Mostert, Opperman and the SAPS Committee, Clause 18.3 needs to be clarified regarding the meaning of generally accepted practices and procedures. The words which may apply to it generally in 18.3 are a problem, as it is not clear whether this envisages practices that are generally accepted for the sector or type of organization, or whether there need to be some other mandatory connection, for example, a requirement in law, for example, if the requirement is due regard to a mandatory practice. 18.3 is unnecessary. We argue that subclause 3 aims to introduce an objective test in order to ensure that the security measures to be introduced by the different responsible parties are in line with a general law established for or employed by all sectors within a specific sector. Clause 21, Office of the Premier Gauteng, it is not clear how the department will control or monitor whether the operator is adhering to the security measures referred to in Clause 18. We argue, Mr. Chair, that Subclause 2 requires that the relationship between a responsible party and an operator should be governed by a written contract between the parties that specifically address matters such as the establishment and maintenance of confidentiality and security measures. With regard to Clause 20 sub 3, Center of, for Constitutional Rights, to ensure that an operator not domiciled in South Africa complies with security measures required in SA, need additional provision in bill stating that the contract governing the processing make our laws applicable. We argue that the proposal appears to be without merit, since any breach of an information protection principle will attract liability to the responsible party and not the operator. The office of the Premier of Gauteng, does the department have jurisdiction over operators not domiciled in the country? We argue that the relationship between the responsible party and the operator is governed in terms of a written contract or agreement between the parties concerned as far as the stipulated principle is concerned. With regard to Clause 21, the CGE, they argue that the clause should also cover the utilization of personal information as it is more harmful than access and acquisition. The department's response is that the reference to utilization as opposed to accessing or acquiring personal information appears to be redundant. It is difficult to contemplate any scenario where it will be possible for a third party to utilize information without first acquiring or accessing the information. Subclause 1 therefore aims to introduce the requirement as far as the earliest stages of the security compromises are concerned. Clause 21.1b, Kusatu, argue that the wording is confusing. They say it makes no sense to take information from a data subject who is unknown to the employer. The department's response is that the provision is not only applicable to the employment law. The example targeted here is, for instance, where a large database is compromised and the responsible party is not able to identify each individual separately. And we apologize for the two spelling mistakes, Mr. Chair. Clause 21.2, Office of the Premier Gauteng should have a specified time period and not simply refer to as soon as reasonably possible. The department responds by indicating, it is submitted that the introduction of an objective test in this regard is the only feasible method of introducing the obligation. Various factors such as the extent of the security compromise, the number of affected data subjects, and the size of the data banks should be taken into consideration to determine the period within which notification should take place. The introduction of a specified period may have the effect that certain responsible parties who will not be able to comply with the requirement within the specified period may possibly opt not to comply with the requirement at all. Kusatu, with regard to Clause 21.4, communication should take various forms and languages, should be communicated to the trade unions. We also said that this proposal is a matter best left to be addressed in codes of conduct where such a need may be identified in a specific sector. 21.6, Banking Association of South Africa. Clause 21.6 should be amended to empower the regulator to direct the responsible party to publicize in any reasonable manner specified to ensure that the media costs and coverage of such required publication are relevant and reasonable. And we responded, Mr. Chair, that the proposal at this stage appears to be sound and is supported. Clauses 22 to 24, ESCOM recommends that the fee charged is prescribed to prevent a debate about what is excessive. The applicable forms found in PAIA may be relevant to Clause 22, but may need to be adapted for Clause 23. It recommends that the regulator prescribe an adaption of the relevant form. The department responds by indicating the recommendation is catered for in Clause 22.1b Roman 2, which provides for a fee to be prescribed by the minister. The bill envisages that the minister will be empowered to make regulations. The proposal with regard to existing forms prescribed in terms of PAIA at this stage can only be noted, Mr. Chair. 22.1 MIH Internet Africa. Compliance with Clause 22 is not practical. An exemption should be provided from having to comply with Clause 22 if the data processor is merely processing personal information that is already in the public domain or accessible by the public on request, provided that the data processing is not contrary to the legitimate interests of the data subject. We do not support the proposal, since even public information will only be provided on request by the data subject concerned. This is not entirely new, since a similar right has been in existence through the operation of PAHIA for the past 9 years. Clause 22.1a, the responsible party should be required to cooperate with the data subject. Clause 22.1a should be framed in positive terms, require responsible party to confirm. The proposal is not supported since the provisions of PAHIA are made applicable to the extent mentioned in subclause 4. The Banking Association of South Africa with regard to 22.1b Roman 2, they ask how can a fee prescribed by the regulator be excessive? We respond that the logic associated with the request is noted, and it is proposed that paragraph B Roman 2 should be reworded as follows by just referring to a fee prescribed. Clause 21, the same subclause, the Office of the... They raised the same matter, Mr. Chair, and we just refer to our above comment or response. Clause 22.3a, Banking Association of South Africa. The written estimate of fees referred to in 22.3a must be given, if so requested by the applicant. We are of the view that if the proposal with regard to the rewording of subclause 1b2 is accepted, then a consequential amendment will have to be effected to subclause 3a, to the extent that the responsible party must in all instances provide an estimate of the prescribed fee. Clause 23, AVUSA. Clause 23 grants data subjects what amounts to editorial power over stories published about them in the media, or at least the ability to materially affect editorial integrity of the media. The effect is to undermine freedom of expression. First of all, we once again refer to Annexure A, but then we raise the question whether editorial power can be exercised over stories published. That is the bottom line. Clause 23.2, Banking Association. Clause 23.2 must be made subject to paragraph D. On the receipt of a request in terms of subsection 1, a responsible party must subject to subsection D. We argue that paragraphs A to D should be read disjunctively. The different actions to be taken by a responsible party as stipulated in paragraphs A to D are mutually exclusive. It is therefore not clear why paragraphs A to C should be made subject to the provisions of paragraph D. So we merely raise a technical issue, Mr. Chair. The Center for Constitutional Rights with regard to clause 25A and clause 32A, the right of children under the age of 18 to consent in certain circumstances is recognized in international treaties and conventions and is recognized in our law. For example, the Sexual Offences Act and the Children's Act. The bill does not recognize that children in certain circumstances can consent. And I think, if I remember correctly, this is also an issue that was pointed out during the public hearings. But the response simply, Mr. Chair, if we look at those provisions, is that the provision envisages a child under the age of 18 years and only when that child is under parental control. Kusatu. Clause 25B, prohibition on processing of special personal information, should include medical illness or history of anything to which the data subject objects to. The proposal is not supported since the term health in this context also includes medical illness or history, in our view. Reference to anything to which the data subject objects to is not feasible in view thereof that a prohibition of this nature should clearly spell out what special information is. The phrase anything to which the data subject objects to will render the provision vague to a point where any type of personal information could, at the instance of a data subject, be transformed into special personal information. The Center for Constitutional Rights, bill protects information about a person's criminal behavior as special personal information. Section 42 of the Sexual Offences Act establishes a national register for sex offences against children and mentally disabled persons. Believes that public interest in information outweighs the right to privacy. Obviously, there should be a distinction between a convicted criminal and a suspected criminal. We argue that clause 31.4 creates an exemption to the extent that the prohibition does not apply if such processing is necessary to supplement the processing of information on criminal behavior permitted by the provision clause 32. MMF and SAHA, the bill prohibits the processing of special personal information, although there is general exemption where processing necessary for obligations in law. This may cover obligations of public archives. The special needs of private archival institutions are not provided for. The effect is that archival institutions would not be able to process special personal information without consent or a specific exemption from the regulator. They recommend that the historical statistical research purposes exemption that was in the 2005 draft bill be restored. This is already an issue that we have pointed out yesterday, Mr. Chair, with regard to the comments, similar comments made by the, by them, and we already indicated that we would like to consider proposing an amendment as it was contained in that 2005 draft bill. With regard to the Banking Association of South Africa, the clause 32, they propose that two additional paragraphs be inserted to paragraph 8 with regard to the extent that processing is required to combat money laundering or the financing of terrorism, and a new paragraph G, processing is required to establish union representation as provided for in labor law. With regard to the proposed new paragraph 8, we say that it's already catered for in clause 31(1) and 4 and clause 32(b). And with regard to the proposed new paragraph G, we argue that it's already covered under clause 28(1) or 2. Massmart, transactional data, which includes which goods were purchased, date of purchase, etc., should be exempted, provided and not used for direct marketing. The proposed exemption cannot be supported in view thereof that the proposal appears not to take note of the fact that transactional data of this nature will always be accompanied by personal information. Kusatu recommends that the regulator may only authorize processing after application made to court. The proposal creates an unnecessary and onerous burden which in any event will dilute the powers of the regulator, which in the final instance will be contrary to the establishment of the regulator as an alternative to costly court procedures. ASISA, clause 34 should allow the regulator on application to provide temporary exemptions in respect of one or more provisions of the Act under circumstances where a particular industry or body cannot reasonably be expected to achieve timely compliance. Our response is that it's not necessary to create a general exemption in clause 34. The fact that the regulator will have to decide what is reasonably practical in respect of many information protection principles already gives effect to the proposal. SANEF, public interest is defined in terms of security interests rather than a board interpretation of the term. We argue that paragraphs A to E of the definition of public interest contained in clause 34(2) is not a closed list, and it is therefore not clear why the view should be held that the term is defined in terms of security interests only. CGE, clause 34(a)(1) is too broad. The use of the word any is problematic because it suggests that all personal information can be processed in the public interest warrants such an action, HIV status. The clause should be rephrased to be in line with the limitation clause. Our response is that the essence of a public interest provision is that under certain circumstances it will justifiably require that individual interest should be subservient to it. 34(2), they propose a new F, and that is the Public Service Accountability Monitor. They argue that the regulator may authorize processing of personal information which may curtail constitutional rights, introduces hurdle as regulator will act as gatekeeper, recommends that 34(2) is amended by adding a further example of what public interest includes, F, and they propose that those organizations, non-profit, pursuing a public interest objective, which may involve accessing and processing personal information in the furtherance of constitutional rights and public interest objectives, and especially those organizations which have a specific interest in holding public duty bearers and private duty bearers to account for their actions and or decisions and or performance in the course recourse particular public resources. We argue that the proposal is laudable, however special treatment of organizations pursuing public interest objectives is unnecessary. 34.3, SANEF. The comment rights there, Mr. Chair, is also addressed in our annexure A. And with regard to 34.1D, the Office of the Gauteng Premier, clause 31.1D, 34.1D may prejudice the data subject. The processing should occur if the data subject consents that the processing is beneficial. What may be construed as beneficial may by the responsible party may not be construed as beneficial by the data subject. We argue that it's not the responsible party that makes a decision, but the independent regulator.
Thank you.
We're done. Running through the list. Honorable Smith.
Would you allow me to move to slide 12 to raise something which I think has not been correct, if I'm wrong, but I don't think it's been directly addressed. And rather than leave it to next week, can I just introduce my doubts about the special personal information part B?
There we go. I want to express my doubts, unless I'm misreading or misconstruing, about special personal information. Now, that's the category of information where there's a flat prohibition. Nobody may process personal information concerning certain things, including religious, philosophical beliefs and political opinions, and then there follow some exemptions. But I would like to understand why. The exemption on religion says that essentially only a church or comparable institution can hold a list of its members, and there is something about families. And the one about politics, once again, says a political organization can only build lists. The pages are 16 and 17. And sections of the clauses are 26 and 29. Now, you can only build these data banks about your members, basically, and you can't supply to third parties, that's fine. But I'd like to understand, I mean, the right to hold beliefs and opinions and the right to free expression are based on the idea that there is also a marketplace of ideas in this country. It's part of free speech. And presumably if a religion wants to do mission work or proselytize, and for that purpose wants to hold records of people's expressed views, with all the usual consents and et cetera that are required under the principle, why can't they do that? We're basically stopping mission work. And if a political organization wants to expand its support base, I mean, on what grounds does one prohibit them from keeping records of people's views and which people hold them? Yeah, let's leave it there. But I don't understand why these prohibitions surely fly in the face of the marketplace of ideas, which is part of the right to free expression.
In election campaigning, you go door to door, you phone. Sorry? Okay. You phone. You phone arbitrary people. You knock on doors of people who maybe, if it's a by-election, may be hostile. You record, this person is nasty, they seem to be a DA supporter.
Well, I'm on the floor. Okay. Now, is that not going to be prohibited? But that's part of general political campaigning. A newspaper will often run, particularly the more community-orientated ones, a survey. And they'll have photographs of people, you know, what they thought of Helen Ziller. You know, and their pictures are there. And obviously they've consented to it, they've given it voluntary, or they've said, no, I don't want to say. And then there's a picture. So is that not going to be affected? Just maybe just if through you, Chair, if they can, following on from Dean's point, just explain that.
Yes, I think that was the same argument that the media also raised in so far as the newspapers were concerned, and they actually said that they would have to go and ask for an exemption every time they do that in terms of Chapter 4. But I think what is missing there is that you have to also consider Clause 32, which is general exemption. And it says that the prohibition of personal information as referred to in 25 does not apply if A, it is done with the consent of the data subject or the parent of the child, if it's a child, and then B is actually the one that I think will be applicable to newspapers and everyone. Processing is necessary for the establishment, exercise, or defense of a right or obligation in the law. So the right to free expression. Sorry? 32B. The prohibition won't apply if processing is necessary for the establishment, exercise, or defense of a right or obligation in law. So the right to free expression or any of the other rights that are protected in the Constitution and in other pieces of legislation or in the common law will then fall under that exemption.
That doesn't make me happy at all, because then why write a flat prohibition? Which cuts out a lot of legitimate activity that's going on, and don't underestimate the importance of the mission work.
But Chair, also just following on from that, you know, so in the exercise of the right of free political activity, my party can keep records of all the people in a particular ward. Is that what is being said?
Yeah, but then why prohibit in the first place?
I think that usually what they make the distinction. The idea is usually that if you deal with special personal information, it should be with the consent of the person. That's the first, just sort of the general idea around it. But then also, if you need to do that in the establishment or exercise of or defence of a right or obligation in law, it comes from the EU directive. Directly, actually, the way that it's been phrased. And I think that the idea is just to emphasize the importance of those areas and that you will need to sort of think about it clearly before you can just go ahead. I think that's something that's important in the legislation as a whole, is that it asks of everybody. And that's also from the journalists, to consider people's privacy before you act. It's not something that you can just go ahead and do without thinking. You must, in everything that you do, you must first think, assess the situation, and include privacy as part of your design objective. So we always say it's not a hurdle to overcome, but you must, in everything that you do, always consider privacy, and that's what the Act actually asks you to do in many instances. It's not that you're not allowed to do it, but before you do something, you must just think, how is it going to affect the privacy of people? And that forces you to do that. So,
yeah, I mean, we may be getting on too much into the detail, but, I mean, we have got a little bit of time, and maybe this will initial discussion will help us. You see, my problem with the whole principle approach based approach is it then becomes unclear as to what you can do and what you can't do. And it's a little bit like, so if we're used to making laws which say you can do this, you can't do that, isn't everybody going to be quite confused when it comes to these are the broad principles, and now whatever you want to do has got to be interpreted by yourself and ultimately by the courts whether you can or not. So that's just a general comment. The one thing I would be interested in is, I'm
perpetually sort of grappling with this idea of, on the one hand, the law is necessary to protect people's personal privacy rights against commercial exploitation. In other words, the unsolicited, I mean, with respect to the stakeholders that are sitting there and there. On the other hand, it deals with much more than that. It deals with general passing on of personal information in the media and so on. And I'm not sure whether it's confusing the two, having them together. The one question I'd like, and maybe it's something that they can look at, is as far as the sort of general non-commercial processing of personal information, how is this law going to change that? If you take out everything that isn't commercial, that isn't processed for to get some, to make money, how is it going to change things? So, like, for example, the door-to-door canvassing of a political party, how is it going to affect what the media can write in their article, whether they're going to... that kind of thing, because I think just we need to know where this thing is going. I mean, I just find it, and you know, there are restrictions in existing laws. So medical records, it's already restricted. That didn't help the former Minister of Health. Is this going to help her? If would this have helped her, rather? This hasn't helped, the existing law hasn't helped Caster Semenya. Would this change it at all? I would like some kind of more of an idea of how it is going to affect, forget about the commercial side, where information is processed and collected for commercial gain, commercial value, advancing your product or whatever, and you get monetary gains in or material gains in some way, but the rest, how would it change things?
Probably it's a matter that I think which will call for further prosecution by ourselves, because the more Honorable JJ and Smart are actually engaging on this issue, the more you begin to realize that there's more than that which meets the eye, and we need to be very, very clear about a number of issues. But there are two issues, maybe the last one that Rabbi Jeffrey said. That is a comment to say. Maybe that's why it's important when we process any legislation. The first thing that must be put very clear up front is a clear problem statement. Because it's when the problem statement is properly articulated. That's why one day in this meeting I said, as we meet here, Mr. Hank, we're not necessarily all of us legal people, but we're political people who have to deal with particular issues that are ordinarily understood by ordinary people. So it's always important to say, how is it going to resolve those particular problems? Even when you make a problem statement, you make it in line with what is generally understood as a problem that is affecting society. But that's one issue. The second issue is that what makes me to think that we need to discuss this matter further, having listened to Honorable Jeff and Honorable Smart, is that to what extent would it undermine the minimum necessary social interaction? To what extent would it really block it and just stifle it unnecessarily? And I think we may think that is not important, yet that is very, very crucial. If you listen to what they are saying, maybe when they respond, they will deal with that. Because media every day will tell you what so and so, the survey says, DA 5%, ANC 95%. So the DA might be very much interested. How do we deal with that situation? And then, how are they going to deal with that situation without contradicting this law? This is just one example. The point I'm trying to make that I think I share the concerns of the two honorable members. And I think we need to, therefore, like you said during tea, probably also we need to engage and see a balance between the technically required aspects of this bill, purely as an ordinary law, and the philosophy within which it, the philosophical environment within which it it operates, and find a balance. Maybe that discussions need to be actually engaged and clearly engaged. What is our philosophical environment? What is the genuine issue it's trying to deal with? And how do we find a balance between ensuring that those issues are dealt with without violating the minimum required elements of the environment, philosophical within which we operate?
Following on that, could Ananda kindly just remind us, I'll go and read the big report again this weekend, but on the EU directive, there are more than one reasons why this was done. One was the request of Parliament when the PIA was written, but secondly, the immediate need is to give effect to the EU data directive for trade purposes. Now, the Canadian way of dealing with exactly the problems that Mondley has just stated, of course, the Canadians have a privacy law for the public sector, and then they have the one that deals with commerce, finish and class, those two. So it's clear and simple. But that's North America. Under the EU directive, what is the injunction to a country like ourselves? We're not an EU member. But is one supposed to deal with privacy across the board, or is it arguable that one could deal with the commerce and trade aspect only?
Yeah, I think you could answer those questions, even the observations. But I think at the end of that, I want to suggest that you, going back, prepare a memo. Which deals with one, why EU passed this legislation for themselves? Why? What do you think are the reasons? It would answer partly this issue, because then we know the genesis, the beginning of this act. Was it for commercial purposes? Was it for private purposes? Was it for both? Just to check that briefly. So because before going to clause by clause, we must be able to say this is the overall. Yeah, it answers the question, why is this law? What is the problem? What is it that we want to solve? Yeah, what is the mischief that we want to remove? Yeah. So I think that would inform you. And obviously then, the second part of that memo then say, what is our own, restating what you told us, but now in writing, so to speak, summarizing, not a thesis, but just in simplified forms, you know, 2-3 paragraphs explaining to us why South Africa have to pass this law. And then you explain the methodology that is. These are the things we want to deal with, and so and so. That's why we are going to formulate it, blah, blah, blah. Some of these things are attended to in this hour. Talking about our domestic legislation, there are areas where some of these issues have been covered. Just to refer to it, as far as we're concerned, this particular thing is covered here and there. Because you have been involved with drafting most of this law, so you have a rough idea of just a sample of our laws which deals with information about individuals. Yeah, that would assist us to begin our discussion before we go into clauses, clause by clause. Yeah, let's go and answer this in the next 10 minutes, and then we'll release you so that you can go home and rest a bit after lunch, and start working again. Thanks. Okay.
Yes, I think the question was about the how does the EU adequacy actually work, or how can we do it in sections and so forth. I think what's important there is what you put in is really what you get out. It is possible to do it in sections. However, the first prize would be to have adequacy for the country, because if anybody then wants to do anything, they do not have to concern themselves with privacy issues. So if any responsible party, because the way in which it works is that the responsible party, say for instance in Germany, a German financier or whatever, is responsible to ensure that he or she doesn't transfer information to South Africa if we do not have adequate privacy legislation. So it's in the hands of the actual responsible party. Now, if that responsible party can just go to the EU list and look and see, well, South Africa is one of the parties that have adequacy, then they don't have to concern themselves with anything at all. If not, then the second thing that he can do is to look whether a specific piece of legislation has been declared adequate. That's a possibility. But whether what he wants to do falls within that adequacy requirement. If not, if that doesn't happen, then he must look into the activities of that entity that he wants to send the information to, and actually see whether that entity can, on a private basis, on a contract basis, comply with the adequacy requirements. And, then if not, then you can't send the information. So there are different sort of levels of compliance that you can get. We've decided, it was after a lot of consultation and after two discussion papers that we came to the conclusion that it would be better to have a generic act to deal with everything at the same time. Worldwide, what has happened is that the countries had privacy legislation for government first in all instances. That was in the 70s or the 80s. That was more or less when the first time that they had privacy legislation. And then only in the late 90s, early 2000, 2001, 2 or so, did they add in the case of Canada, for instance, they added for commercial purposes, and in many other countries they added a private sector, a law for the private sector, to add to the government institution. So because of the fact that government holds so much private information, and that, that was deemed to be the area that needed the most protection before they got to the commercial side of things. Now, it's very important to include both of them, and I will give you one example. For instance, the UK pension officer in charge of pensions, international pensions in the UK, has been actually visited our offices on two occasions, and they have been trying for years to assess the situation in South Africa and the UK, where people are either living here or there, and then they're drawing pensions, state pensions, in both countries. They're not able to do that correlation to see whether there's actually fraud being committed, because of the fact that they're not allowed to send the information to South Africa. And they've even visited South Africa to come and see whether they can't solve it. So they are very anxious for this legislation to be passed. Now, that's nothing to do with commercial activity. It's just the ordinary government-to-government situation. And there are many others like that. There are many examples of that. So it's important to have it for at least for government and for commercial activities. Whether you want to exclude some of the areas in the private sector, that is something that can be debated. It can be done, and then you will just get your adequacy for that area that you've included in your bill. But the problem with that is then you leave out the other areas. Now, what's going to happen to them? It's going to be a patchwork of content, and we can come here for the next 20 years and debate legislation for each individual sector, because that's what happens in America, for instance. They don't have to have a Privacy Act, once again, for government, but they don't. They have sector-specific pieces of legislation for the rest. And they don't regard it as important to have a general act, because they come from if you remember from the briefing on the first day, the EU comes from a human rights perspective. So they are very concerned about that aspect of it. The OECD countries come from an economic perspective. So they are not so concerned that everybody should have this right, because they don't really feel that strongly about the right to privacy. What they want is for business to be able to be conducted properly. And so they have different acts for each specific sector. But there are so many loopholes, and you have to come to Parliament, and each time you want to protect a specific sector, you have to have a separate bill. I mean, you can be engaged in privacy legislation for years and years and years to cover all the sectors. So that is why it was thought that it would be a better idea to have one generic act and rather deal with the specific sectors in codes of conduct. But I don't think it will be helpful if we, for instance, exclude government, because that is really the basis of a lot of information, and that's really not been done in any country. Insofar as the private sector is concerned, sometimes, as I say, in Canada, for instance, they have just narrowed it down. But the thing is, then you leave open a lot of, why do you not want to protect the information of the other areas? I mean, personal information can be infringed in all areas. So, it's sort of one, also you can do it, but why do you want to do it? And especially the countries that are coming to the table now later, they are able to look at this now holistically and make use of the experiences of the other countries. So if we want to follow the same route that they did and see, oh, it's necessary for this, no, we must add this, no, what about that, you know, and that's the way that it's been dealt with, because they actually, it originated there. We can do that. But, I mean, it's a much more laborious process, and, I mean, in the end, you've got little bits and pieces everywhere, and you don't have... It's so easy if you can say South Africa has adequate privacy legislation, and then nobody has to think about it ever again. You know, it's not a concern to anybody again. So I think... But it is possible, and if you actually, once the bill has been enacted, or if we think that it's more or less now in its final form, I think it will be a good idea to actually contact the EU and have them have a look at it to see if it actually is in order, and they would be able to assist us. The body that actually decides about adequacy is the Article 29 committee, and it's made up of all the information commissioners of the EU. And they actually look at the bill and to decide whether they're going to provide adequacy to that bill. The last one that has actually received adequacy is the Argentinian legislation. Argentina actually received adequacy, and they can go ahead as, you know, there's no worries about that.
Well, that's a very interesting one. We don't need approval from other people, but it's quite issues of sovereignty and so. But we will discuss those later.
Okay. What I wanted to say is that Ms. Sloan? Yeah. I think my proposal that let's reinforce what the chairperson is asking. Because the approach you guys are taking, which could be useful, then challenges the kind of language that is going to be used to put together a principle-based law that must be very sensitive, that must actually enjoy multi-sensitivity to all these things that we're speaking about. That's the challenge you must accept. That approach, therefore, puts more load at the language, must be said. It ensures multi-sensitivity to minimum commercial flow. It ensures minimum sensitivity to reasonable minimum social interaction flow, and all those kind of things. That line, that's exactly what it does. Of course, when you go to specific areas, you just deal with that specific area. But if you take this one, if you look at how South African commercial law, for instance, has been actually couched, it is not in what do they call it, thoughts and whatever, not a principle of thought. They are using few principles, but those principles have passed the test over years to deal with many issues of competition. The language then becomes very, very important, that it must demonstrate that it is sensitive to what Honorable Jeffrey and Honorable Smart have said. It must show sensitivity, because we're talking about investor-friendly country in a free market environment. And all those, the human rights, the point I'm trying to stress is that it calls then for a particular type of level. So mastery is required at that level. Thank you. Yeah.
Mr. Jeffrey?
Yeah, just
yeah, I mean, I hear what Ananda's saying, but I think the concern is are we then not being too wide that we then end up with a whole lot of unintended consequences? And I think the trick is to get around that. I mean, this example that both Dean and I gave of party canvassing, I mean, it would seem as though that is restricted. You don't think it's restricted? In what way? In terms of that clause you referred to. It's so complicated. That's the difficulty. And if you look at some of the submissions that we've been going through, I mean, it's clear also that I think that's the difficulty, is this is very, very complex. And is there a simpler way of dealing with it? Should there be a difference between, for example, collection of information and dissemination? So in other words, you can go and you can go and write down who you're seeing in going door to door, but you're not allowed to publish that in the newspaper.
Or sell it.
That kind of thing. Because at the moment, processing is just collection and dissemination and publication. So I don't know. Those are, it's not necessarily for an answer now, but I mean, those are the difficulties. Just saying that I've got where we are at the moment.
Okay, but we're cut out for next week. Wednesday, Tuesday, the parties will go and reflect. Individuals, we need a caucus on Tuesday. Spend almost the whole day doing that job ourselves from our side. So that we interrogate most of these questions. Now we'll meet on Wednesday to begin to look at loss by loss and so on. And to agree on the actual program, which are out one to Bonani and company to prepare for us, so that we then have a program of how we propose to deal with this legislation, the time frames and so on, so that we are very clear, every one of us, how to go on with this one. I think that's where we are.
Yeah, just for clarity, are we not dealing with the magistrates on Wednesday, or has that been changed?
No, I think we can squeeze. Let's think about it.
Because I'm just concerned, given the sort of public interest here, I don't know how many people have flown in, that we, I think, if not now...
Then we can push the magistrates almost to the last day before we rise. Let's work on the program, and then we will propose the program to ourselves on Monday. You remember the disciplinary stuff that we need to just take? Yeah. But that doesn't need a long, long time. No? Yeah. So thank you very much. Today is Wednesday. I hope the department gets some bit of rest. I will promise.
Sorry.
Thank you.